Undisclosed, The Killing of Freddie Gray, Episode 14, is brought to you by The Skim and Third Love. Make sure you listen in for those spots later in the show, and please support our sponsors because they support us. Also, a reminder to listeners that the research, analysis, and opinions of the investigators, journalists, academics, and lawyers who you'll hear on this program about the circumstances surrounding Freddie Gray's killing are just that. Research, analysis, and opinions. We encourage listeners to reach their own conclusions and to vigorously debate our conclusions with us. Enjoy the program.
As the news of Freddie's injury and later his death spread across Sandtown and then all of Baltimore, seasoned activists, worried parents, frustrated teenagers, and curious reporters took to the streets to figure out exactly what happened to Freddie after he was taken into custody. For nearly 2 weeks, from late April to early May of 2015, Baltimore and Freddie Gray dominated the news, Twitter feeds, and public conversations about what would happen next. Although the majority of protests were peaceful, things did take a turn, and soon Baltimore streets resembled a battlefield, complete with makeshift command stations for the governor, uniformed National Guard on street corners on patrol, and everyday people bewildered and terrified by what had become of Baltimore. Today, we look at the Baltimore uprising and discover that the roots of all of it go way deeper than 2015. Hi and welcome to Undisclosed, The Killing of Freddie Gray. My name is Rabia Chaudhry, and I'm here with my colleagues, Dr. Marcia Chatlin, Justine Barron, and Amelia McDonald-Perry.
My name is Amelia McDonald-Perry, and I'm a former blog editor and a journalist for RollingStone.com and CrimeFeed.
I'm Marcia Chatlin. I'm an associate professor of history and African-American studies at Georgetown University, and I'm also an Eric and Wendy Schmidt Fellow at the New America Foundation.
My name is Justine Barron. I'm a screenwriter, researcher, and columnist at the Jewish Journal.
After nearly 5 days of unrest in Baltimore, a Sun reporter captured a scene from a city reeling from a tragic death, chaos on the streets, and the presence of the National Guard to restore as much order as possible. The Washington Bureau writer described smoke billowing from the West Baltimore shopping districts mingled with a drizzle to cast an ashen pail over the whole city. The fire-pitted East Side slums started sending up plumes of smoke again about noon. A two-alarm fire ripped through the looted remains of a liquor store at Federal Street and Milton Avenue. A three-story warehouse burned out at General and Holbrook Streets, and another store was put to the torch at Hartford and Lanville Streets. Soldiers used tear gas to disperse a crowd of 300 youth who had smashed into the H&E self-service grocery at North Avenue in Chester, the vicinity of the most intense arson and looting Saturday night. The nearby Western District Police Station was ringed by the guardsmen as a surly crowd looked on. This was Baltimore in the spring of 1968, 5 days after Martin Luther King Jr. was assassinated in Memphis, Tennessee. King was actually scheduled to travel to Baltimore in late March, but instead decided to go to Memphis, where black sanitation workers were striking for equal pay and for improved safety conditions. After the announcement of King's death, cities across the country were stages for peaceful, somber remembrances, as well as sometimes violent and destructive confrontations with police, until the citizen soldiers of the National Guard were deployed on domestic soil. Baltimore in April 1968 mirrored D.C., which mirrored Newark, which mirrored Chicago, which mirrored Los Angeles. The reaction to King's death, named the Holy Week Uprising because it preceded the 1968 Easter holiday, was not the same as the Baltimore Uprising that came 47 years later. Freddie's death at the hands of police, the national conversation about police brutality reignited by Michael Brown's death in Ferguson 8 months earlier, the capacity of anybody with a smartphone and a data plan to act as a citizen journalist, the 24-hour news channels, the city's mostly black political leaders, and the black president watching news about Baltimore from the White House. These circumstances all mark the difference between the then of 1968 and the now of 2015. But the pleas for justice, the tears streaming down the faces of mourners, the shouts of no justice, no peace, and the fear that lingered over the city made it hard to believe that the world was watching America in the 21st century. The feelings of déjà vu were strong in Baltimore, and for those old enough to remember the Holy Week tragedies, the question of what had not changed in America was perhaps more relevant than what had changed. For 11 days, Baltimore became a shorthand on the news. A reporter had to simply open a newscast or an online story update with, "Today in Baltimore," or "We return to Baltimore," or simply ask, "What's going on in Baltimore?" and audiences would understand. Baltimore meant failure, and depending on what network you prefer or who you ask, either people were irrational in their anger or the city was failing its citizens. Either way, despite all the news reporting coming out of Baltimore, what happened to Freddie didn't become clearer in those days. What did surface was the various dynamics that have shaped and controlled Baltimore in those days. The nation saw the mayor unable to communicate to her own city, awkwardly trying to say that she respects civil liberties, but then referring to protesters as thugs. Police Commissioner Anthony Batts was equally unable to address questions and tried to represent himself as caring, but was often unconvincing. While Rawlings, Blake, and Batts were the official voices of Baltimore, the country also met other leaders, the heads of local organizations, the pastors, and the unelected officials of blocks and neighborhoods who resisted the official City Hall line. And when they were afforded a little bit of airtime between the scenes of burning buildings and arrests, they talked about the work that needed to be done in Baltimore. They told stories about Freddie and tried to de-escalate tensions. These characters all converged on April 18th, 2015, the day before Freddie died. News of Freddie's injury has spread, and protesters begin to march from Gilmore Homes and end their procession at the entrance of the Western District Police Station to demand answers. The police created a barricade around the station. They knew how to prepare for this. The questions were swirling. How and why was Freddie injured? Who was going to be held accountable? What was going to happen next? The Western District Police Station has been a site of protest for years. The first Western District office opened in 1826, moved in 1876, then settled at its current location on 1034 Mount Street in 1959. In July 1969, protesters gathered outside the Western to ask that a patrolman receive consequences for failing to restrain a police dog that bit a 30-year-old black woman named Helen Smith. Smith claimed that the officer, Alvin Nachman, unleashed the dog on her. She needed 75 stitches on her right leg. In June of 1972, a small group of 15 protesters met at the Western to ask why Ronald Nelson, a 28-year-old man, was arrested for allegedly selling stolen goods, never charged with any crime, and was released from police custody with a bloody mouth and nose. Protesters chanted, "We're watching, we're watching." And in 1980, the local NAACP chapter led a march to the Western District to demand an investigation into a case involving Franklin and Bernadette Crockett, who, while traveling to West Baltimore to visit family one Friday night, claimed that they were stopped by a police officer who eventually called in 10 other officers who beat the Crocketts and several onlookers before arresting the couple and some bystanders in front of the Crockett children. And so in 2015, as a community marched to the Western District and carried signs that said, "Black Lives Matter" and "Get Well Freddie," they may have known that this was not a first in Baltimore, and they probably hoped it would be the last.
No one was arrested. Relik Hayes, then a coordinator for the activist group Baltimore Block, was involved in organizing a number of the protests that first week. Here's how he described the mood.
I remember a deep feeling of love and unity and sadness. The entire community was out in the streets in Gilmore Homes, and mm-hmm. there was protesting. There was sadness, but there was also like a feeling of community and love. And this was before the media. So this is while Freddie was actually still alive and he was still in the hospital. I think there was some hope that, you know, he was going to survive and pull through.
Freddie's stepfather, Richard Shipley, told the crowd that day, "If this happens to him, it could happen to any of you."
If you're anything like me, you make it your job to know exactly what's happening in the world today. Well, 2017 is a really busy year, and there is way too much going on for one person to keep up with it all. So that's why you need The Skim. They give you all the important news and information you need to start your day in 5 minutes or less. They serve up news right when you need it in one simple email every single morning with style and no BS. It's fun, informative, and guess what? It's totally free. The Skim covers politics, world events, sports, and entertainment, so you'll have some serious facts on hand when you're talking to coworkers, want to impress your date, or just for your own knowledge. And this is not a free trial. The Skim is always free, every single day. Nothing to pay and only knowledge to gain. So join the over 5 million people who wake up with The Skim every morning. Sign up today at theskim.com/undisclosed and you'll be entered to win a $250 Visa gift card. That's theskim.com/undisclosed. The Skim with two M's spelled the SKIMM.com/undisclosed. Sign up right now for The Skim and enter for your chance to win a $250 Visa gift card at theskim.com/undisclosed.
Sunday, April 19th. Around 7 o'clock that morning, Freddie was pronounced dead at the University of Maryland Medical Center Shock Trauma Unit. Protesters returned to the Western District, demanding answers with a greater sense of urgency for some type of recognition of what just happened and a roadmap for how accountability would work. Protesters from every walk of life conjured up the freedom songs of the 1950s and 1960s as they chanted and marched. Many of them walked with their hands on top of their heads or their hands up in front of them as if they were surrendering, the way that the hands up don't shoot protesters did in Ferguson that past August. Monday, April 20th. Mayor Stephanie Rawlings Blake, Police Commissioner Anthony Betts, and Deputy Commissioner Jerry Rodriguez give a press conference about the pursuit, Freddie's condition before and after he entered the van, and the lingering questions about what exactly transpired 8 days earlier.
Relique Hayes of Baltimore Block distinctly remembers that the mood changed once Freddie died. It wasn't just that the community was now in mourning. The police presence dramatically increased.
The next day, we're outside, and like, there's cameras from everywhere. Police cars have popped up, like, police presence has tripled in the Western District. They have barricades. They were definitely more aggressive, and this is a common behavior of Baltimore police. They're really nice during the day or calm during the day, but once it starts to get dark outside, tactics change, aggressiveness heightens. You fear for your life. Like, I think the uprising was like the pinnacle of them practicing those tactics, but they had been happening way beforehand.
The protests begin to spread from the Western District to Baltimore City Police Headquarters and City Hall.
So we want to say to the nation today, we want to say to every news outlet that we are sick and tired of being sick and tired. And we are here today because we fear that if we don't stand, our sons, our nephews, our cousins, our daughters could in fact be next in line.
Local activist and minister, Elder C.D. Witherspoon's fiery remarks in front of Baltimore City Hall, his declaration that people are sick and tired of being sick and tired, comes from Fannie Lou Hamer, the elder of the Mississippi Freedom Movement. Ms. Hamer, as she was known by her colleagues in the Student Nonviolent Coordinating Committee and the Mississippi Freedom Democratic Party in the 1960s, was one of many black women who experienced police brutality because she attempted to register to vote. Mrs. Hamer visited Baltimore in 1966 to attend a meeting about organizing for economic and political power and to participate in protests about housing conditions and public accommodations. Like Hamer, Witherspoon has worked on behalf of voting rights in Baltimore to ensure people with felony convictions understand their rights. Tuesday, April 21st. The six police officers responsible for Freddie's death are identified. Maryland's congressional delegation calls for help from Washington, D.C. Attorney General Loretta Lynch directs the Department of Justice to open an investigation into the Baltimore Police Department. Later in the evening, Freddie's parents lead a march to Presbury Street, where Freddie was arrested. Freddie's mother, Gloria Darden, collapses near the street and is taken away. With Freddie's death, Gloria Darden joined a sisterhood of mothers who lost children due to police violence and racist civilian violence. One group of grieving moms, who calls themselves the Mothers of the Movement, were watching the dispatches from Baltimore closely. The mothers, Sabrina Fulton, who lost her son Trayvon Martin, Leslie McSpadden, who lost her son Michael Brown, Valerie Bell, who lost her son Sean Bell, Gwen Carr, who lost her son Eric Garner, Geneva Reed Veal, who lost her daughter, Sandra Bland, and Lucia McBath, who lost her son Jordan Davis, could relate to Darden all too well. A week after the protest, Sabrina Fulton visited the Gray family. Wednesday, April 22nd. Baltimore's Fraternal Order of Police, Lodge No. 3, holds a press conference expressing their unequivocal support for the officers in the case. Gene Ryan, president of the lodge, likened protesters to a lynch mob because the calls to arrest the police officers were becoming a cornerstone of the protesters' demands. Ryan walked back his comments, but the Fraternal Order of Police hasn't historically been supporters of protest, unless they are the protesters. In July of 1974, the Washington Post reported, "The clenched fist, that symbol of militants that police often confronted on the picket lines of protesters, now belong to patrolmen in Baltimore, too, as they march in their first strike. Between 40 and 75% of Baltimore officers decided to form a picket line and ditch their duties to protest after the city approved what they deemed a meager 6% raise. One officer, Ronald Ward, asked, 'Why does everyone else have the right to fight except us?' The strike was a first for Baltimore City Police, which replaced a work slowdown as the preferred strategy for making a case against the city. Officer Ward added, 'Yes, we have a commitment to the law, but we also have a commitment to each other.' In Freddie's case, officers' commitments to their fellow officers would appear stronger than the commitment to the law. In 2016, Ryan was reelected as president of the lodge. The protests began to expand beyond the four key locations of the Western District, Presbury Street, Police Headquarters, and City Hall. Protesters were moving onto streets, obstructing traffic and moving towards the city's prized tourist destinations, the Inner Harbor and Federal Hill. Federal Hill is a National Park Service historic site because many of the buildings in that neighborhood are from Baltimore's early years in the 18th century. Federal Hill used to be a struggling neighborhood, but the city encouraged urban homesteading there in the late 70s, and slowly but surely it became a hot neighborhood, with rehabbed houses and Italian restaurants straight out of Central Casting, with red and white checked tablecloths, gelato shops, and outdoor movie screenings on summer nights. North of Federal Hill is the Inner Harbor, which is also an important place for Baltimore's history, because it was the site of the Pratt Street Riot. The Pratt Street Riot was a confrontation on April 19, 1861, between a mob of secessionists who wanted Maryland to join the Confederacy and Massachusetts Army troops on their way to Washington, D.C. Citizens got involved, throwing rocks at the Army soldiers. Some call the Pratt Street Riots the first blood shed in the U.S. Civil War. A month later, Union troops came to Maryland to suppress the state's secession movement. Maryland remained a part of the United States after the turmoil, but wouldn't abolish slavery until 1864. Protecting the Federal Hill and Harbor Place may have been on Governor Larry Hogan's mind when he announced that he was sending 32 Maryland state troopers to Baltimore to help police. He also announced that he was going to sign a bill that would bring body cameras to all Maryland police departments. He also announced that officers could not take leave until things quieted down.
Two protesters were arrested that day for disorderly conduct and property destruction.
Friday, April 24th, Commissioner Batts reveals that Freddie was not seatbelted in the van. Some of the CCT footage is uploaded to YouTube. Governor Hogan calls a special session of the Maryland legislature to pass bills that doubled the payouts to victims in police brutality settlements. Protests continue.
In 2014, all BPD officers attended an in-service training for 3 days. One day was Range Day. It's when cops are annually certified to carry their firearms. The other 2 days involved classroom and hands-on learning on topics that change every year. That year, one of the topics was crowd and protest control. That's not covered in the academy. BPD has declined to provide a copy of that curriculum, but sources tell us that the training only covered 3 to 4 hours of watching videos and learning some basic techniques like arm-in-arm formation, moving forward and back to help control crowds, and using batons to push back protesters and contain them. The scenarios they looked at were largely nonviolent. So BPD police received nothing that addressed crowds becoming violent or destroying property. One thing police did learn was that they were not supposed to break formation and charge after protesters, which is something that we saw in the photos and videos of the events of April 25th. In 2015, there was only one active BPD policy about crowd control, and it had been written in 1977, General Order H4. It's called Freedom of Speech, Rioting, or Inciting to Riot. This is very old. Most policies are updated at least every 10 years. Like many of these older policies, H4 tells a story. It describes how the police serves to protect the free speech of crowds, unless there is a clear and present danger of violence. It references 2 Supreme Court decisions that protect the freedom of crowds to gather and speak. On July 1st, 2015, 2 months after the violence in Baltimore, Anthony Batz's administration finally updated this order. It took on a different tone. Policy 804 still affirms the right of peaceable assembly, and it gives some examples in which those rights must be protected. But then it moves very quickly onto how, quote, these rights are subject to reasonable restrictions, which includes rioting, but that's poorly defined. It gives permission for lieutenants and higher-ranking officers to interrupt crowds if their speech is threatening violence, or a threat to peace is present or imminent, which is very vague. So much for the clear and present danger of the original policy. The updated protest control policy is as confusing as much of the language that came from Batz over the years that he was in charge, veering sharply from a very progressive to a very conservative agenda, to put it simply. Batz's leadership reflected that confusion, which became very apparent during the events known as the Baltimore riots on Saturday, April 25th and Monday, April 27th. For instance, by asking officers on the one hand to show up in military riot gear before there were any signs of trouble, but then, on the other hand, telling them to stand down and not intervene at all, even if they saw looting or vandalism, even if they themselves were spit upon.
Stop tugging at your bra straps and second-guessing your size. It's time to put fit first with Third Love. Third Love uses women's real measurements and super-smoothing memory foam to create bras that fit better and are more comfortable. They offer sizes from AA to G, as well as their exclusive half-cup sizes. Just answer a few simple questions online, and Third Love will recommend a bra in the right size and style for you. I don't usually have what anyone would describe as cleavage, but with Third Love's push-up bra, I look, no joke, kind of stacked. And it's also the most comfortable bra I've ever owned. It's like a unicorn. And now, Third Love is offering you a chance to try one of their perfect 24/7 bras free for 30 days. Just pay $2.99 for shipping, and you're on your way to a perfect fit. You'll get to really live in this bra. Feel free to wash it, wear it all day. You might even forget that you're wearing it. If Third Love isn't your new favorite bra, just return it or exchange it for free. Go to thirdlove.com/undisclosed now to get your perfect Third Love bra and try it for 30 days. That's thirdlove.com/undisclosed to try your new favorite bra for free. thirdlove.com/undisclosed.
Saturday, April 25th.
On April 25th, the day after Commissioner Batz announced the revelations about Freddie's arrest, demonstrators again marched from City Hall to the Inner Harbor, not far from Camden Yards, where the Orioles were playing against the Boston Red Sox. Here's Hayes again.
So, well, I was one of the organizers of that action. along with a lot of my block team were actually what we call marshals, pretty much directing a march and keeping folks in line with wherever we're trying to go, we're trying to do. So I see the police, I see the tactics, so I know they're going to kettle. I know that chemical weapons are next, so we weren't expecting to do anything that aggressive. And then I remember us being at the stadium and a white person calling the black person nigger. And the police are right there, they don't do anything about it, and the guy reacts. And that's what sparked off the uprising. I remember that particularly because the 5 miles I ran from, I literally walked from Gilmore Homes to downtown.
Wow.
And then back to Camden Yards when everything sparked off and when that Devin got that iconic time image. Like, I can tell you exactly where I was when Devin got that image because we were running together. He stopped to take the image, and I stopped and looked back at him like he was crazy.
A small group of protesters reportedly became violent, smashing multiple police car windows, throwing rocks, and blocking a nearby intersection. During the ninth inning of the game, the announcer came over the loudspeaker and told the nearly 37,000 fans in attendance that city officials had asked that no one be allowed to leave the stadium due to, quote, ongoing public safety issues. Their containment was brief, and the game went into extra innings anyway, but the incident got a lot of press. Suddenly, the national media's eyes were turned on Baltimore. Alan Bullock, a friend of Freddie's, was in the crowd of protesters down near Camden Yards and inadvertently became an early face of the unrest, or at least the media's presentation of it. The 18-year-old was filmed standing on top of a police car, wielding a traffic cone, which he used to break the cruiser's windows. Bullock wasn't arrested that day. His mother recognized him when the footage aired on TV and made him turn himself in because, quote, it was the right thing to do. His stepfather warned him that the police would, quote, find him, knock down our door, and beat him if he didn't. But the judge didn't go easy on Bullock, who was facing 8 felony charges, and set his bail at a whopping $500,000. In late April of this year, as the Baltimore Sun marked the 2-year anniversary of Freddie's death and the uprising, they published an op-ed by a Department of Corrections retiree named Hal Riedel about, quote, all the fun Bullock had had, quote, after Freddie Gray died. No, really, that was the actual lead to Riedel's detailed breakdown of Bullock's legal troubles over the 2 years since the death of his friend. According to the article, on May 7th, 2015, Bullock's mom got together enough cash to get her son out, giving a bondsman $15,000 in cash. She also agreed to pay an additional $35,000 in $500 installments for the next 70 months. Bullock didn't get a resolution in his case until February 2016. Prosecutors were seeking 11 years in prison, while his defense attorney was willing to take a plea deal for a suspended sentence and 5 years probation. Bullock ended up serving 4 months and had to write a letter of apology to the police department. His bond is far from paid off. The April 25th protests continued into the night, with demonstrators gathered in front of Western District Station, where they were met by police in riot gear. A little after midnight, someone in the crowd hurled a rock, which ricocheted off an officer's shield. According to photojournalist J.M. Giordano, who was covering the protests for the Baltimore City paper, quote, they mobilized. The police line moved in, targeting his section of the crowd, and Giordano was hit with a police shield, knocking him to the ground. His colleague, Baynard Woods, captured video and can be heard shouting in the background.
He's a photographer! He's brass! Photographer! He's a photographer!
They just swarmed over me, he told City Paper the next day. I got hit, my head hit the ground, they were hitting me, and someone pulled me out. Giordano and the man standing next to him both took a beating by the police. Giordano wasn't arrested, though, a fact he attributed to a few of the officers recognizing him as a member of the local media and wanting to avoid any additional negative press. Photojournalist Serkan Gürbüz, who was covering the protests on assignment for Reuters, was standing on the sidewalk on the periphery of the crowd. He saw Giordano knocked to the ground and immediately turned his lens in that direction. One photograph shows a man surrounded by cops in riot gear, his bright orange sneakers popping against the sea of blue uniforms. In the foreground, an officer faces the camera, an accusatory finger pointed in Gorbuz's direction. Quote, a few seconds after that, I was being knocked to the ground, too.
So some of the protesters started throwing various objects at the officers in riot gear. Mm-hmm. And when the officers charged against the protesters, I saw that they knocked down Joe Giordano. He's a photographer for Baltimore City Paper. So I immediately ran to the side of the street where I could photograph this couple standing on the sidewalk. I started photographing. The officer tried to block my camera, prevent my, you know, journalistic activity, basically. It sort of resembled a man-to-man basketball defense. So I just, you know, I stayed calm and I moved my camera around to have a clear shot because somebody's like trying to block my lens. So I'm moving my camera around and I pushed the shutter button and kept taking pictures. And then he charged towards me and yelled at me to step back. You know, his mask was inches away from my face. So I put my camera down. I took several steps back until I reached this wooden ledge. So I basically ran out of the room, you know, so I asked them to designate a spot because that's usually what they do. If they don't want you to be there, they're supposed to tell you, you know, where you should go. So I said, where do you want me to go? And then I heard somebody yell, arrest him. And I was tackled and my arms twisted in the back and pushed down and handcuffed. And, you know, I think it wasn't necessary. I mean, if they asked me, hey, like, we're going to arrest you, extend your arms, I would. I mean, I wasn't going to, like, you know, do anything. And I had my credentials. They were yelling, like, you're resisting. And I was not, actually. They were pushing me down. I kept reminding them the moment they, you know, they were trying to handcuff me, I told them, like, I'm a journalist. You know, this is your, you know, you're violating the First Amendment. You know, I wasn't doing anything wrong. I clearly identified myself. I mean, I don't think there was any way that you would think that I was doing something else there.
Though he wasn't taken to central booking and was released by police later that night, he was given a citation. At first, he said, police said they planned to charge him with disorderly conduct, but they changed their minds and cited him for a, quote, failure to obey. He refused to sign the incident report, which he said did not accurately describe what had occurred between him and the officers. Reuters rightly made a stink on his behalf, and ultimately BPD dropped the citation and offered Gurbuz an apology. Even still, Gurbuz told me, they achieved their goal.
They effectively stopped me conducting journalism. So that's whatever the outcome is, that doesn't matter. They already achieved their goal in a way.
After a rough night on Baltimore streets, Freddie's sister, Frederica, pled for peace on the street alongside Mayor Rawlings Blake.
My family want to say, can y'all please, please stop the violence? Freddie Gray would not want this. Freddie's father and mother does not want no violence. Violence does not get justice. Thank you.
The next day, she and her family host Freddie's wake. Sunday, April 26th. Freddie's family hosted his wake at the Vaughn Green East Funeral Home. His casket remained open. His family dressed him in an LA Dodgers baseball hat. Protesters paused for a moment and became mourners. Some gathered near the funeral home with signs that said, "We remember Freddie, and our hearts are with the Gray family." Monday, April 27th. Freddie's funeral at Shiloh Baptist Church was open to hundreds of visitors. People who never knew Freddie visited and paid their respects. Shiloh has been a bedrock in Black Baltimore for generations, and a few church elders probably can remember when a young Martin Luther King Jr. preached a sermon there in 1953. After the funeral, marchers gather from Presbury and Mount to the Western District.
On April 27th, after Freddie Gray's funeral, organizers had planned on a quiet day in respect for his family and his passing. That morning, Anthony Batts went by the Western District to talk to the district officer, preparing them in the event of any activity, regardless, given what had taken place two nights before. Sources say that during that meeting, Batts did not mention some news that he then dropped later that morning. At 11:43 a.m., the Baltimore Sun's Justin George tweeted a joint statement from Batts and Captain Eric Kowalsik, Director of Media Relations. It said, "The Baltimore Police Department Criminal Intelligence Unit has received credible information that members of various gangs, including the Black Guerrilla Family, Bloods, and Crips, have entered into a partnership to take out law enforcement officials." Then it said, "This is a credible threat," with "credible threat" in bold. By the end of the day, other law enforcement bodies were questioning this report, and soon enough, BPD admitted that they couldn't verify it. But Batts doubled down the next day, saying that the gangs had met right after Freddie Gray's funeral, made plans to each kill an officer, and that this was valid and verified. The credible threat seems to have had one or more possible sources. First, a gang member named Robert Meach Tucker, according to the city paper, had announced at a protest on April 22nd. All that gang shit, all that Reds and that blue shit, that shit out the window right now, feel me, we going after them. And he pointed to cops. That was one person and 5 days before. We also learned from sources that a particular officer by the name of Frank Golomowski, with a reputation for bad gang intelligence, who had been previously discredited by the FBI, provided this information to police. He might have been a bad source, or he might have been an easy person to blame. Regardless of where it came from, the credible threat warning was not kosher policing. Batts issued the statement without vetting the source or even letting his officers know. They learned it from the media, too. It was a bizarre, stunt-like move for a police leader, but so was giving the task force 11 days to solve a possible homicide. A few hours later, on April 27th, police and media began tweeting out that teenagers were planning a purge for that afternoon, meaning a day of lawlessness based on a couple of movies that had been released in 2013 and 2014. This purge was supposed to start at Mendowman Mall after school and head south toward downtown. As a result of the purge threat, various institutions in Baltimore shut down. The University of Maryland released a statement that they were closing early due to reports from the Baltimore Police Department of scheduled activities today, beginning at 3 p.m. Putting together the credible threat with the purge, it all seems like BPD leadership was on especially high alert that day, or they were looking for a story. What we know now is that by issuing these stories and preparing police for the worst, BPD predetermined its fate. They seem to have contributed to a riot.
Mendowman Mall, named after a corn god in Longfellow's The Song of Hiawatha, in many ways epitomizes the way that Baltimore's racial demographics have shifted, leaving behind the most vulnerable and poorest citizens to fend for themselves. Opened in October 1956, the mall was home to a three-story Sears department store, grocery stores, and the White Coffee Pot, a restaurant that segregated black and white diners. After the Holy Week uprising of 1968, the mall's shop owners started to leave Baltimore. 4 years earlier, the Civil Rights Act had guaranteed all Americans access to public accommodations, like shopping malls. But by the late 1960s, several white-owned businesses resisted the change in the law by shuttering stores and moving to the suburbs. Eventually, Sears left, and the mall became a social services office. Mendowman Mall is now in its third act, a hub for working and middle-class shoppers, mostly black, featuring a Target, a Marshalls, and a Shoppers grocery store. The transportation center outside the mall is the convergence point of 10 bus lines and a subway stop, so its closure sent several folks into a tailspin about how they or their children would get home that day.
The burning and looting of the CVS and some other stores on the evening of the 27th at Pennsylvania and North Avenues became the most commonly reported scenes of the riot. That event was frequently conflated in media with what happened earlier that afternoon at Mendowman Mall, where teenagers, it was said, started a lot of trouble. CNN reported, In a sobering example of life imitating art, the chaos sweeping the streets of Baltimore may have been partly inspired by a series of action horror movies. Baltimore police said rioting at a shopping mall and elsewhere Monday afternoon started amid rumors spread on social media of a purge led by large groups of marauding high school students. So let's talk about what really happened and the truth about these so-called marauding students. The Daily News reported that afternoon. At 3 p.m., news cameras caught live scenes as dozens of students descended on Mendowman Mall, where they were greeted by lines of police officers wearing riot gear, carrying shields, and armed with pepper spray. Police were pelted with rocks, water bottles, and anything that came to hand. This was generally the story that was told about what happened that day. The teenagers were referred to as demonstrators or protesters or rioters. The Baltimore Sun reported, "The students began pelting officers with water bottles and rocks. Bricks met shields. Glass shattered up and down Gwynn's Fall Parkway. Officers spread mace. Confrontations bled into side streets where officers threw bricks back. A heavily armored Bearcat tactical vehicle rolled through the neighborhood. One officer, bloodied in the melee, was carried through Westbury Avenue by his comrades. Police used tear gas to move crowds down the street." Those are the accounts. Unfortunately for these reporters, teenagers did not descend on the mall that afternoon to fight with police. And it's not clear at all that they were the primary aggressors or that the fights even became that serious. Only Mother Jones published a piece the next day called "Eyewitness: The Baltimore Riots Didn't Start As You Think." It included detailed eyewitness accounts from teachers and parents that counter the dominant narrative. Then, on May 1st, the website The Baltimore Eclipse published a piece called "The Battle of Mendowman" that took off from where Mother Jones started. It is the most comprehensive telling of what really happened on the afternoon of the 27th, and it uses images from helicopters, some of which have been removed, and real-time video and audio accounts by witnesses. So here's the real story. School buses arrived at the metro station around 3 p.m. to drop kids off from school in the area. Many of these teenagers were planning on hopping on the metro or a city bus to go home. Some were going to be picked up by their parents. Others walked over from nearby Frederick Douglass High School on the other side of the mall to ride the metro. Now, our police sources tell us that this area can be a bit of a hangout spot for kids after school and that sometimes fights do break out, but no fights apparently broke out that day among the youth. Police were ordered that afternoon to show up before 3 p.m. in riot gear, stop the school buses as they arrived, shut down the metro station, shut down the mall, and not allow the youth to leave. Teenagers were forced out of buses to stand around on the grass by the train station and were not permitted to head home. The police also began blocking the streets so that many parents were not able to come by and pick up their children. In the sequence of images, you can see cars initially pulling up and away, and then cars being blocked from arriving at all. At 3:01, the Baltimore Police Department posted on its Facebook page, "There is a group of juveniles in the area of Mendowman Mall. Expect traffic delays in the area." Juveniles. A Frederick Douglass teacher named Megan Harris posted on Facebook what really happened. She wrote, "We drove into Mendowman knowing it was going to be a mess. I was trying to get them home before anything insane happened. Then Douglass students in huge herds were trying to leave on various buses, but couldn't catch any because they were all shut down. No kids were around except about 20 who looked like they were waiting for police to do something. The cops, on the other hand, were in full riot gear, marching toward any small social clique of students. It looked as if they were hundreds of cops." And then she said, if it were her, she'd be ready to pop off too. From the images and accounts captured on the Eclipse website, you can track the events of the afternoon as it progressed. At first, the young people stand around in small groups, like teenagers do, wearing backpacks, looking confused, even a little amused, about the presence of dozens of police officers in riot gear, with plastic shields in front of their faces, holding plastic shields in front of their bodies, in tight formations. Where's the riot? The cops are largely white men. The kids are largely African American. At one point, some of the kids start holding up their arms, saying, "Hands up, don't shoot." This is scattered, not terribly organized. None of the kids sound that angry yet, and many of the kids are filming the police on their cell phones while they say this. They still look like teenagers waiting for a ride, with the added intense curiosity of a massive police occupation. There are a few signs of police aggression. Several cops suddenly rush a young man, pinning him against the bus stop wall, dragging him to the ground. It's not clear from the video what he did or said first. It doesn't appear to have been that serious. Slowly, journalists arrive on the scene, filming this battle that had no battle. Megan Harris, the teacher who shared her account, told Mother Jones, "The kids were standing around in groups of three or four. They weren't doing anything, no rock throwing, nothing. The cops started marching towards groups of kids who were just milling about." Another Douglas teacher told Mother Jones that most of the students wanted to get out of the area and avoid any purge-like violence. Some were requesting rides home from teachers, but by now it was difficult to leave the neighborhood, she said. A local elementary school teacher wrote to Gawker, "I saw the armored police vehicle arrive. Those kids were set up. They were treated like criminals before the first brick was thrown."
Natanya Duncan, a professor at Morgan State University, one of two Baltimore historically black colleges, remembers that day vividly. She was miles away at a mall in Columbia, Maryland, and she started receiving alerts about the transportation shutdown. She was worried about how a friend's son would get home from school that day, and she also started to fear for her students, who she knew would be out protesting. An informal network of warnings started to spread. After battling a two-hour drive back to Baltimore, she pulled into her apartment lot parking complex and immediately pulled back out. Her students were contacting her and asking for help.
So some of the students ran away from the police, away from combative situations. Not everything that happened that evening, that night, was reported on. And so I found students who had been affected by tear gas. I found students who had fallen while running and were harmed by other running people. And there were students who were being held somewhere in flux between arrested but not booked. I remember very distinctly panicking. Some of the students who were in custody were actually graduating seniors. One of the students who was in custody, I knew privately, was pregnant.
The images and videos posted on the Eclipse article of the Mandelman showdown are startling and strange. At one point, a group of cops, still in formation, crossed the street towards a small group of civilians that do not appear to be especially aggressive. Then, suddenly, the cops back up across the street, still in formation, going backwards. It's hard to tell why. Given so little apparent threat, it all looks like a police training video. It looks like an absurdist dark comedy. There must have been some logic to the moves that the police were making that day. They are seen at one point blocking Liberty Heights Avenue. There are scattered teenagers on either side of them, unable to pass. In these images, the crowd of teenagers numbers about 20, and the police number over 50. For me, these are the images of the early moments of the so-called riots that truly resonate. Again, these children have no place to go. They are stranded. The images that most people saw of Mandelman, however, that's what happened shortly thereafter. Images of smoke bombs and aggression. At 3:33 p.m., the police tweeted, "People are continuing to throw rocks and other objects at police officers in the area of Mandelman Mall in Liberty Heights." 6 minutes later, they tweeted, "A group of juveniles are still in the area of Mandelman Mall. We are hearing reports of bottles and bricks being thrown at officers." Helicopter footage shows the standoff. The cops have either followed or driven the youth into the neighborhood to the northeast of the mall on Westbury Avenue. The video shows some of the kids throwing stones at police and some police retaliating by throwing stones back. Even what looks like a lieutenant in a white shirt joins in. The kids then approach the police en masse and the police retreat again in their backward formation. This leads to some kind of smoke bomb being thrown in the direction of the kids, who disperse. I have no idea where they went. Let me pause and introduce an idea in police reform. It's called the guardian mindset. It's when police view themselves as guardians over the people they serve, rather than warriors. A guardian officer would, above all, protect children from harm, make sure they got safely to their home, not push them into battle. What is clear about Mandelman from the pictures and videos is that it was an occupation. The only way any of the behavior of the police seems to make sense is if you actually thought that these kids were planning a purge. But the teenagers who were there were the general student body. No effort seems to be made by the police to figure out who, if anyone, was purging. Towards the end of the 1 to 2 hour standoff, the police are seen in formation, moving the kids away from the mall, forcing them to head south on Reisterstown Road. It's not clear where the kids are going or how they are getting home, but less than a mile down that very road is the intersection of Penn and North, the major scene of violence and looting that night. Let's back up and talk about the purge threat that shut down Baltimore. I've done a lot of research and there is no hard evidence that this threat ever came from teenagers or even civilians, although there does seem to have been talk about a purge for several days. The so-called flyer that was allegedly handed around and shared on Instagram, it only seems to have been shared by reporters and conservative websites commenting negatively on it. At 2:30 p.m., about a half hour before the buses arrived at Mandelman, Baltimore Sun reporter Carrie Wells posted to her own Twitter account the mysterious flyer. It looks to me like it was computer-generated to seem faded. It has strange vertical and horizontal white lines that don't come from it being folded. It says, "All high schools Monday, @3, meaning 3 o'clock. We going to purge, from Mandelman to the Ave, back to downtown, #FDL. Which the Urban Dictionary tells me means fucking down low. The flyer has a picture of a young man, Alan Bullock, on top of a police car, which came from that Saturday night's violence. The majority of comments on Wells's post ask her for the link to the original flyer, or at least to one teenager posting it. Her responses included, "A friend posted it after seeing it on social media." And then, "Also, it wasn't like I was the only one who saw it. Our reporters were seeing it on social media /getting sent it all weekend." Oh, okay. Reporters were getting sent it. By teenagers? And then she wrote, "Yeah, I don't really get the obsession over it, to be honest with you. People certainly purged that day. Come again? Who purged? I'm really trying to understand reporters. I wish the Baltimore Sun would answer one of our questions. They have a media department, you know, which shuts down inquiries like this." Another website, Fair and Accuracy in Reporting, or FAIR, looked into this and found no other instances of the flyer. I also ran reverse image searches. This was the same week during which conservative sites gave birth to the rumor that Freddie Gray had a pre-existing spinal injury, and BPD was leaking one false story after another about how Gray died.
Riots broke out across the city, buildings burned, and by morning, central booking was bursting with a couple hundred new arrestees. According to BPD, 235 people, that's 201 adults and 34 juveniles, were arrested overnight between April 27th and 28th. Within the next 24 hours, over 100 people would be released without charges, though a BPD spokesman insisted that all had been lawfully arrested. It just wasn't clear for what or by whom. BPD said they plan to review video footage and other evidence and would seek appropriate charges at a later date. Quote, "We're not giving up on them," Commissioner Batts promised. Ultimately, the department did give up on most of them. The majority of those released without charges never heard from police after that. There's a clear pattern to the accounts given to the local media, who had reporters sitting outside of central booking, pen and paper in hand. They were simply in the wrong place at the wrong time, swept up with swarms of others, thanks to what appears to be BPD's strategy of mass arresting anyone in the nearest vicinity of some unlawful behavior, like a store being looted or a burning trash can. A man named Brandon Owens sued BPD for wrongful arrest, saying he was on his way to Mondawmin Mall to buy groceries when an officer struck him with a baton. When he demanded his badge number, the cop replied, 666, and then arrested him. Owen spent 2 days at central booking before being released without charges. One guy, a father of four, said he was simply walking home when police suddenly threw him to the ground, put him in handcuffs, and confiscated his belongings, including his wedding ring. Another man claimed he was just out for a walk on Pratt Street, which was unusually quiet and empty, when police descended and put him in handcuffs. He had no idea why he was arrested. Many reported that they were never even given any sort of paperwork. Were they counted amongst BPD's tally of arrests? Or, if there's no paper trail, is it as if their arrest never happened, except for that whole business with the handcuffs and the long night or two in jail? Not everyone got to go home so quickly, though. People facing charges for assault, destruction of property, and inciting a riot, for example, were held on bails of $10,000 or more, much higher than typical and well beyond many of their means. Quote, "The bails that we're hearing about now are out of the ordinary," Paul B. DeWolf, a Maryland public defender, told the Baltimore Sun. "Some of these people are children. Some were just picked up off the street. It's not been proven that they were guilty of anything." In the end, many wouldn't be found guilty or even get their day in court before prosecutors dropped the charges. One woman sat in jail for nearly 7 months, unable to afford the $50,000 bail before her case was thrown out. Police and prosecutors swore they'd hold looters accountable. But in the end, the number of successfully prosecuted cases reflected the city's usual disparity in the number of arrests versus convictions. In the vast majority of cases, either police or prosecutors decided there simply wasn't enough or any evidence to prosecute.
Natanya Duncan returned to the city streets later that night, responding to the messages and calls from her students at Morgan State about friends injured or lost in the protest. She made an interesting observation about what happened at the CVS.
The crux of it became that they burned down the CVS and they were stealing from the CVS. And there were even reports that drugs were stolen, you know, prescription opiates, etc., were stolen from the CVS, and that it had flooded the Baltimore drug market. And there was some report that there was an increase in the amount of overdose and all of these other things. And I'm going to tell you what I saw people stealing. I'm not going to lie. I saw people stealing baby Pampers. I saw people stealing Tide detergent. I saw people with toothpaste and toothbrush. I saw people with Dove body wash. I saw kids with candy. I saw people with sanitary pads, feminine hygiene products. But I don't know if they broke the vault and stole all the pills, but what I did see people taking were what we would consider to be life necessities. I'm not justifying what anybody did who participated in that, but I think that it's an interesting commentary that when people raided the CVS, they took Tide and Snuggle. And I just didn't see people walking around with bottles of cough syrup or, you know, bags of pills. I didn't see that.
There were some plea deals and convictions, including for a few high-profile incidents involving the destruction of property. Raymond Carver was sentenced to 4 years in prison for starting the fire that burned down the CVS located at Pennsylvania and West North Avenue, across the street from what's known as Stop 5. He's also required to pay $500,000 in restitution. And then Gregory Lee Butler, the man who punctured the fire hose that was used to put out the fire at the CVS, he was sentenced to 3 years of federal probation.
One of the inevitable elements of a tense moment like the days after Freddie's death are rumors. Rumors of organized attacks, rumors of gang truce conspiracies to attack police stations, and rumors of victims, police officers, and protesters. In the buzz of misinformation, the reality is that in the heat of the moment, people do things they may not otherwise imagine doing. This is how it works. All the forces of stability are gone, and the weight of years of injustice become unbearable. People are taunted and provoked, and things get out of control. In the news coverage of the uprising, there was a tendency to talk about all the destruction wrought by looters and criminals, but the reality of Baltimore is that many buildings, many, had been abandoned or destroyed decades earlier, and there was never enough money, never enough power, or never enough political will to rebuild them. Governor Hogan declared a state of emergency, and Mayor Stephanie Rawlings Blake announced a curfew that would go in effect the next day. Tuesday, April 28th. Immediately, the cleanup efforts begin. Netanya returned to Baltimore with her students to lend a hand. Reporter Scott Gilmore from the Canadian magazine Maclean's interviewed people in Sandtown, asking them about how they made it through the uprising. The night before, Randy Howell stood outside his apartment, which sustained damage from a fire. Quote, "I ain't mad," he said. "They burnt it down." He talks about a store next door to him that also burnt in the fire. They only sold liquor and cigarettes, no fruit, no fresh meat. He expressed more anger at the police sirens approaching. For the first time ever, the Orioles played a game against the White Sox in an empty stadium, the outside gates locked. The remaining games were moved to St. Petersburg, Florida. A policy analyst estimated that the game's cancellation cost the local economy $10 million. In Washington, President Barack Obama, taking the tone he often did in these moments, weighed in on Baltimore from the White House.
With respect to Baltimore, let me make a couple of points. First, obviously our thoughts continue to be with the family of Freddie Gray. Understandably, they want answers. And DOJ has opened an investigation. It is working with local law enforcement to find out exactly what happened, and I think there should be full transparency and accountability. Second, my thoughts are with the police officers who were injured in last night's disturbances. It underscores that that's a tough job, and we have to keep that in mind. And my hope is that they can heal and get back to work as soon as possible. Point number three, there's no excuse for the kind of violence that we saw yesterday. It is counterproductive. When individuals get crowbars and start prying open doors to loot, they're not protesting. They're not making a statement. They're stealing. When they burn down a building, they're committing arson. And they're destroying and undermining businesses and opportunities in their own communities that rob jobs and opportunity from people in that area. So it is entirely appropriate that the mayor of Baltimore, who I spoke to yesterday, and the governor, who I spoke to yesterday, work to stop that kind of senseless violence and destruction. That is not a protest. That is not a statement. It's people, a handful of people, taking advantage of a situation for their own purposes, and they need to be treated as criminals.
Hundreds defied the curfew that night, though the atmosphere was significantly tempered in comparison to the mayhem the night before. 35 people were arrested, mostly for curfew violations.
Different sectors of Baltimore decided to show up after Tuesday night. The Baltimore Symphony Orchestra performed a concert near some of the worst-hit areas. Local Latino civil rights group, CASA, issued a statement about Freddie. Upset by the negative coverage of Baltimore youth in the press, area high school students organized a walkout from local schools and staged a massive peaceful protest. Young people have always marched, and some of the most poignant moments of the civil rights movement came with the 1963 Children's Crusade, when scores of children left their schools in Birmingham, Alabama, to march on the city's downtown to the mayor's office to address segregation. The Birmingham police aimed water hoses at the kids, released German shepherds on them, and arrested hundreds of children, and hundreds more took their place in the march. University of Maryland Baltimore County President Freeman A. Hrabowski, grew up in Birmingham and remembers those days when he marched on City Hall.
The police looked mean. It was frightening. We were told to keep singing these songs. And so I'm singing, I ain't gonna let nobody turn me around. Keep on a walking, keep on a talking, marching on to freedom land. And amazingly, the other kids were singing, and the singing elevates. When you can imagine hundreds of children singing, and you feel a sense of community, a sense of purpose.
Hrabowski hosted a teach-in at UMBC to talk about the protests. He remarked, 35 years ago, the father of Freddie Gray was a student at Coppin State when I was an administrator here. And so this is all very personal for me. Because 35 years ago, I thought that we were educating in a way that the world would be so different by the time you were born. And while in some ways it is in many ways still with the same challenges. Wednesday, April 29th.
Back in Baltimore, according to BPD, 18 people were arrested that night.
Thursday, April 30th.
Kevin Moore, Freddie's friend who filmed Stop One, was arrested along with two friends from Ferguson that night. According to Kevin, the trio was actually on their way home from a protest when police appeared out of nowhere, guns drawn, and took them into custody. While Kevin's two friends were sent to central booking, he was detained overnight at the Western District Police Station. Here's what he told Vice News.
Right. Yeah, I was arrested last night on some false, bogus intimidation shit. Like, they really tried to intimidate me. They really tried to intimidate me, and they took me down to precinct for 6-7 hours. I don't get no charge papers. I don't get no citations. I don't get none of that. So what am I being charged for? You know what I mean? What am I being detained for? Show me some type of love, because believe it or not, 80% of the officers that was in that precinct were my descent, African American. And you can't give me an answer.
What
I don't
did
get my phone
you?
Call.
Did they charge you with anything?
No.
Just violating curfew, basically.
No.
No.
No, because I got caught before curfew. Mm-hmm. You know what I mean? I wasn't in violation of anything. Right. I never even got a citation.
Right. So they just like let you go the next day, just this morning?
You know, they dropped me off back where they found me, man. They knew that if they didn't give me back to my people, that it was going to be crazy.
Moore was released the next morning without charges and was met by news that State's Attorney Marilyn Mosby had filed her own.
Friday, May 1st, State's Attorney Marilyn Mosby announced that she will be charging the six officers in the case. Mosby's declarations are seen by many as a turning point.
To the people of Baltimore and the demonstrators across America, I heard your call for no justice, no peace. Your peace is sincerely needed as I work to deliver justice on behalf of this young man. To those that are angry, hurt, or have their own experiences of injustice at the hands of police officers, I urge you to channel the energy peacefully as we prosecute this case. I have heard your calls for no justice, no peace. However, your peace.
According to BPD, the day that Mosby announced charges, 40 protesters were arrested, mostly for curfew violations again.
Saturday, May 2nd, thousands of protesters march on City Hall. Some describe the mood as lightened because of Mosby's announcement the previous day. The rally featured Cephas Johnson, the uncle of Oscar Grant, who was shot and killed by a transit officer in Oakland on January 1st, 1999. Michael B. Jordan played Grant in the movie Fruitvale Station. This gathering, the largest and most organized of all the protests, reflects a sense of cautious optimism that Mosby's pronouncement the day before would mean that Baltimore could rewrite history, could perhaps carry a new narrative about police and Black communities, an uprising, and the future.
One of the officers assigned to enforce the 10 p.m. curfew that night up at Penn North was Daniel Hersel. Hersel had a reputation for being crooked and abusive, and earlier this year, he was one of seven officers indicted on federal racketeering charges. But even back in May 2015, Hersel's behavior wasn't a secret to his superiors. His internal file was thick with over 30 citizen complaints of misconduct, theft, and violence. In fact, in 2014, the Baltimore Sun's Mark Puente detailed many of the allegations in a feature story about cops who had been repeatedly sued for misconduct, with the police department paying victims millions of dollars in settlements. BPD paid out $200,000 in settlements for Hersel alone, including $50,000 to a woman who said Hersel broke her arm. On May 2, 2015, Herschel earned himself another lawsuit, this one brought by Ford Fisher of the website News to Share, who said Herschel assaulted him on camera. Fisher had captured video footage of Herschel shoving multiple people for not dispersing quickly enough. Fisher was briefly detained by the National Guard, but once they realized he was press and could be out past curfew, they were prepared to let him go. Quote, "Then Herschel came up behind me at that point, threw me face first on the pavement, and said on camera, 'I don't care,'" Fisher told City Paper. 2 days later, at another protest on May 4th, Herschel was seen on an archived live stream, randomly pepper spraying protesters. Fisher was one of six men, all arrested but ultimately cleared of wrongdoing, who filed a police brutality lawsuit against the department and the state of Maryland in April 2016. Another plaintiff, Larry Lomax, was also arrested on May 2nd. But first, an officer sprayed him in the face at close range, not with normal pepper spray, he said, but, quote, "an incapacitating spray used to disperse large crowds." Video footage of the incident quickly went viral. The lawsuit is ongoing.
Sunday, May 3rd, Mayor Rawlings Blake lifts the curfew. The Maryland National Guard begins to leave the city, and Mendowman Mall is reopened for business. The curfew was supposed to last until May 4th, but Governor Hogan, perhaps hearing from businesses that the curfew was cutting into their bottom lines, and the ACLU that the curfew was not being equally enforced, figured it was better to relent on it. Governor Hogan went to Mass that day at St. Peter Claver Catholic Church. St. Peter Claver has been home to Black Catholics in Baltimore since 1902. Rawlings Blank claims that the curfew lasted as long as it did because she was worried about outside protesters. This is a classic one, like the language of outside agitators. Stirring up rural Blacks with ideas like civil rights and equal access to the ballot, outside agitation is a convenient screen for just how pissed off people are from the inside. Duncan thought that the city played a role in exacerbating tensions.
In any event, in any public event, you can't always control who is going to show up and how they're going to behave. But what you can do is set a tone that sanctions the right behavior and welcomes the right behavior, therefore making it difficult for somebody who wants to act differently to be engaged, right? The city didn't do that. And so the right elements and the wrong elements and the confused elements all came together in that moment. Nobody's stopping to ask a UMBC student, are you a Morgan student? Are you a Coppin student? Are you a University of Maryland student? Nobody's asking that. What they're looking at is brown and black and red and white as well. Young people who are in the streets who are about to take over. There was an organized group that set out to protest, and that group got conflated with other people who may or not have the same agenda.
Carsona K. Whitehead, a Baltimore City resident, professor, and local radio personality, marched for 10 days in the street. She marched with her sons, alongside old friends, and made some new ones. She credits local organizations for sustaining the protests day after day. She hopes that Baltimore and the nation won't lose sight of what the protests and uprisings meant.
To imagine a different Baltimore City, to imagine a different experience for people who are economically challenged and living within economically challenged neighborhoods throughout our city, these pockets where you have poverty and food deserts, to imagine what would happen if we rethink the way we made our way through the city, and we rethink the way the city was situated and the way it was set up to isolate certain communities. So that's how I approach it as both an educator and as a parent. As a resident of Baltimore City, there was a concern that we were having our moment, yeah. Our moment where we had to make a decision about the type of city that we wanted to be. What was Baltimore going to become?
A As Baltimore began to return to a kind of normal without the TV cameras, the National Guard, and the protesters, the state's attorney's office, defense attorneys, and city leaders would now shift their attention away from the battle on the streets toward the battle in the courtroom. Next time on Undisclosed, the trials and the killing of Freddie Gray.
Right. Before we thank everyone who has helped us to make this program, I first want to thank you, the listeners, for coming out to support Adnan at his hearing last week. It was a great turnout. We got great support. Listen, the Free Adnan movement exists because of you. We simply could not do it without our listeners. Thank you. Also, thanks to all the folks who came out to Red Emma's for the live taping. While I can't say I was missed, I did miss it, and of course I missed all of you, but the pics from it look great, and the team tells me it went really well. So, thanks so much for coming out. All right, second piece of business. As you know, we rely on advertising to keep this show free. Supporting our advertisers is really, really important because of the flow of advertising money. Advertisers pay for spots on this show. We use that money to produce the show and to make sure that you continue to get Undisclosed for free. Now listen, if you could, do us a favor and go to the following URL. It's podcastlistener.com. That's podcastlistener.com/undisclosed and answer a few short questions. It'd be super helpful. By answering those questions, you're going to allow us and our sponsors to get to know you better. Again, that's podcastlistener.com/undisclosed. And the credits go as follows. Undisclosed, The Killing of Freddie Gray, Episode 14, was co-produced in part by Justine Barron and Amelia McDonald Perry. Justine, Amelia, Dr. Marcia Shatlin, and Rabia Chaudhry co-wrote the episode. Meethal Telhan produced, and Shad Chaudhry consulted. Our audio was produced by Rebecca Lavoie of Partners in Crime Media. Our great sponsors this week were The Skim and Third Love. As an independent podcast, sponsorship is necessary for us to make sure we can continue to produce Undisclosed for you and that you get it for free. Great sponsors make for great podcasts, so please check them out. Patrick Cortez and Ramiro Marquez composed Undisclosed theme music. Nina Muser and Christy Williams design and maintain our website. That website is www.undisclosed-podcast.com, and Baluki does our graphics. You can find us on social media using our handle at UndisclosedPod on Twitter, Facebook, and Instagram. Don't forget to visit us on Thursdays at 6 p.m. for the Undisclosed Addendum, featuring Dee Watkins for a discussion about this week's episode. Follow Dee on Twitter at DeeWatkinsWorld. Ask him questions about the episode with the hashtag FreddieGray and or the hashtag UDAddendum. Lastly and leastly, Undisclosed executive producer is Dennis Robinson, and he looks forward to Thursday for the Undisclosed Addendum featuring Dee Watkins. Until then...